Hi, I'm just gonna gather us back. Maybe if you're far away and you feel like coming a bit closer, that's totally very welcome. So we have Jeanette, and Jeanette is in the chat. And so we're going to keep an eye on that. And Jeanette Stacey was just asking how you're going to be here. And so we're going to have to, keep an eye on your presence. But I wonder also I mean, we've had these amazing different conversations, and there's obviously all of you folks here in the audience. And a lot of different experience in the room. I don't know where we want to start. If we want to, I'm sort of drawn to asking you, Jeanette, if there's something you'd like to start with, so that we have you more as much in the room, in the room again, if there's something you'd like to start with, then we're listening, but also if you want some time, let us know. Okay, lovely. Okay, thank you. And Carl is just informing me of the 30-second delay between the sound coming out of this microphone and coming into the live stream. I'm kind of interested. We've got some extra microphones here. We'll move them around the space. But I wonder if there's anything that any of you would like to say to one another, or anything that anyone in the audience would like to jump in with as a starting point.
I have a question for Pernilla. I was wondering, when you were talking about devices and how you could change them a bit to work better for what you need, can you tell maybe a little bit more about the process of how do you get comfortable with the idea of hacking that and then actually using it for something, that you need? Seriously need, not like playing around. How do you get into a process where you feel like, I'm gonna do that now?
Thank you, for asking. I don't know if I have like one answer, because it's like it's a process, I think. Like for me, it was at least a process. It wasn't something like I had a first I read about it, and then I ordered it, and then it was like in a box for a really long time. And I suppose like one of the things that really also gave me courage is knowing that like the hackers who developed this code are also type 1 diabetics or care for somebody with type 1 diabetes. So that also felt really good, and then knowing that this is made for use, and it's not like surrounding a big profit or a business or that was also that also gave me sort of courage, and also talking about it and making work around it and talking with people around, maybe not with the same disease as me, but maybe with like looking at it from like more than a technical tool, I think, like looking at it also like a why understanding why does it work, why is it working or not working the way it is. That also was also very it gave me like confident to like also like hack to break it open and looking at other ways. And then also I think a lot of free confidence in being already being a maker, so like although it was very new to me technically, but it was like sort of like maybe I think like maybe if you like don't already identify as like a maker or hacker or something, then it can be even more difficult to get into that like zone of confidence where you're like, okay, let's do this. Like, I think,
because I guess especially with like when you're looking at a piece of code, it says something about what you feel every day, but in a language that you may or may not entirely understand.
Yeah,
that's kind of a, and then you dabble in it. I don't know. I just think that's really brave, like to go down that path and then do it anyway. Yeah, super inspiring.
And also, of course, like the community. I mean, there's like a very active community online. That like whenever there's a like I post a question, there's like there's really great support, or like within the community, that's also really helps. Questions, yeah.
And I wonder if the producers of the devices follow the process and take it seriously.
I don't know exactly if they do, but I'm very transparent with my doctor. So my doctor is very supportive. I mean, like she really understands that you just want solutions for these, like the solutions that actually this like technique is offering. Like she can really understand why I would want to do it. And so I don't know about actually if the developers, I mean, I assume they would know what's going on, but I'm not in contact with them, so I don't know. But at least my doctor is, yeah.
Jeanette has responded. Do you want to read it?
So Jeanette's written, I'm happy to have heard all the contributions today, and it kind of gives me hope that more people than we know are working on better accessibility and then better positions for disabled people in the long run. But I really would love allies to step up more and do more. And I think that might be something... that might be something that we could... I think it might be a nice point for you, Stacey, to maybe introduce some of the work that you did at Casco, because in a way what you were doing there was producing a toolkit for people working wherever they are or organizing wherever they are to think more about disability access in the practice of organizing events and running spaces. So that could be something to mention.
Yeah, okay. And it's so nice to be in this event with Jeanette, because we've known each other a little bit here and there, and then we get to be a part of the same thing. It's really nice. I also think people need to step up and do more. I think that there's actually so much that we could do without having to become like experts on access. Even if someone invites you to be a part of an event, you can say like, where's the access information? Or, hey, could you please include your access info when you advertise the event? I want my friends to come. You know, like, it's there's so much that we can just ask for and say, hey, you know, then you can actually, as a person being invited, you can make a contribution, but you can also decide, hey, I don't want to be a part of your really inaccessible event, hanging out with who knows who, doing whatever. So I think that there's, you know, there's a lot there also to say, like, who's invited, you know, to ask these kind of questions. There's something really interesting that Anya brought up recently, if I can share it a little bit, but it's just, there's this, I mentioned a little bit in my presentation, but there is this kind of gap going on, and it's like, we all need to do better, but also there is just, it's just a certain kind of temporality. Institutional time is really slow. There's an urgency, and I also feel that urgency, and I'm also really frustrated, but like these things can't really happen overnight, so what does that mean to attend to them, to give them attention? And it's something like what you shared earlier, Anya, about how now there's a lot of institutions or organizations inviting a sign language interpreter for their event, but no deaf or hard of hearing people are showing up to the event because there's not proper engagement with those communities. And it's slow. Like, why would any deaf people want to be friends with hearing people that are not making an effort to learn sign language? I mean, so, sorry, I don't mean to be so like, you know, but also it's such a reality. So actually just sitting with those realities, it goes for so many other situations of like life seats that we experience and all the different struggles that we're, you know, getting at, which are largely also about class. It's about white supremacy. There's so many different layers to it. So accessibility is one layer, but I think also the internet is amazing. There's so much information there about how to do ad hoc organizing around access. Making this really practical toolkit at Costco was me as a just a person really wanting to make this possible. It was just a lot of research and putting it all into this document. And so it was a lot of effort. And yeah, I mean, there can be consultants that we hire also for these kinds of things, but it's also like, maybe it doesn't have to be so complicated. Maybe it's like real actual engagement and commitment to each other and finding the resources and also moving slow and resting and also sleeping more. Like, we're not able to learn all these things really fast because we're like not sleeping well. We don't have a lot of non-sleep deep rest either. So I think that's a little bit of my like spirited response to that too, and feeding off of Jeanette. Like, I think that we need to do better, but we can do in small ways actually of saying, hey, what's the access of this event you're inviting me to? And also asking institutions to do it too. It's really, it can be really powerful.
I'm gonna invite Vasilis and Eric to talk a little bit about their collaboration in a second, but I just wanted to kind of, something that we were talking about before the event started is, which I think relates to this question of like, what can anyone do from where they are right now? And I think often something I have observed working in the arts is a kind of fear around developing practices of access and accessibility, because there's a kind of fear of like, but I don't know what I'm doing, or I don't have any money and I can't like redesign my building, so therefore I can't do anything. You know, it's this kind of all or nothing thinking. And I think something that's really, really important in the demand that Jeanette's making is that people do something. Everyone can do something now, like as Stacey just said. So I'm gonna just, I wonder if you two would like to say something about, I think this idea of exclusive design is really, really interesting, because in a way this sort of question of like, oh, we have to do everything all at once is also related to the idea that there might be like solutions that fit everyone equally, and that's never going to be the case when we're all so different. So yeah, I think it'd be really nice to hear you two talking a bit more about some of design collaboration as a practice of access.
So what's the question?
So shall I just start? Yeah. So I think there's, if I listen to it correctly, so you mentioned, for instance, where can I start when my building is inaccessible? That's just so expensive to fix it. Well, yeah, that's the wrong end of the question, probably. It should have been designed better. So if right now you make a building with stairs to the main entrance, like our university did with their new building, which is, see, it's horrible shame, of course. Then I think something went horribly wrong. and I wouldn't expect nowadays something like that to happen, still happen. So that's I think it's a design and engineering problem. If you look at the web, accessibility is an engineering. It's part of engineering and it's not part of design. So it's not in the design process to make something accessible. It's part of the task of the engineer in the end of the process, which of course gives many, many issues where you cannot, they cannot fix everything, right? Then the only thing they can do is apply, for instance, the guidelines, and then they say it's technically accessible. But that's it should be part of the design program.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think. Accessibility should be always the starting point when you start to design things, and it's most of the time it's not the starting point. So I think it starts in college. It starts with this, teaching about accessibility in early as possible, and that's what's missing right now in at schools. I see it in buildings. For instance, if you take Amsterdam as a city, it's a very old city. So the old part, you can try to make it as accessible as possible, and you should. But most of all, you should all the things that you are trying to build new should be accessible, and therefore you have to have the knowledge first.
Yeah. And then, question for you: are the guidelines enough then? Or should we take another approach, maybe?
You have to have guidelines to have a starting point. But it should always be a starting point, and you should always look at the guidelines, like, do they apply to you right now in this situation? Because every building you build for somebody else. You can build for me, and I would be very happy, but I can invite my neighbor who has a very different kind of wheelchair or a very kind of different... disability that isn't accessible right then. So you should always ask beforehand, for who am I building this? And I would love to work on the idea that you can make something that's accessible for everybody. But I think the most important part is make it accessible for the one that's going to use it. And then hopefully you can improve on that and keep on improving until you get it as far as possible.
Somebody from the audience wants to respond, if you don't mind.
Hi. I wanted to complicate a bit your point, Vasily. When you say that building accessible buildings is an engineering problem, I'm absolutely vehemently in disagreement there. It's a problem of white, able-bodied men being in charge of the distribution of resources. It's not an engineering problem, it's a political problem. When we talk about inclusivity, having people with disabilities in positions of power would solve half these problems. And rather than having able-bodied people being the ones that then concede on the decisions or agree, like this benevolent thing, no? And when we talk about inclusivity, having black people, it doesn't solve racism, but it creates an awareness of the racism in institution. The same goes about having people with different kinds of disabilities, different able-bodied or not able-bodied capabilities. So no, I don't think that any of these things are engineering problems. They are problems of who is in charge. And I'm always in trouble. I'm always in trouble. So I'm not going to make an exception today. The way you grabbed the mic when Eric was about to talk, and you were, I'll answer first. Well, they are right there. That's not an engineering problem. That's an access problem.
I think I wrongly worded what I meant, because I actually completely agree with you. So I don't see it as an engineering problem. I see it as a problem with the industry that sees it as a that the solution is within engineering. But I see it as it's of course a very complicated and large problem. And the main thing that I think is that if we don't include the people that we actually, and if we don't start designing together with people, we'll never fix it. We're maybe sometimes designing for people, which is better than just following the guidelines, if you ask me, but it's definitely not there. And if you just really start seriously including people, and yeah, I won't grab the microphone anymore, or pay a bit more attention. Yeah, it's true. Thank you for that.
Anybody else? No. You raised your hand a while back. I remember.
No, just a short remark, because I think it's really generous that you published this toolkit that you are working on Casco. On the other hand, I was also immediately thinking, well, it's also then really easy for other institutions to just like grab, right? And like do this gesture that's often an empty gesture of publishing these notes, while you've been like really working hard on implementing accessibility as a practice. And I think this word practice something is overused a lot too, but it's so important to talk about how, like how are we doing this and what does it imply, and also, all these unsexy parts about accessibility work as well, like the practical things. So I was thinking immediately like, oh yeah, we should also talk about licensing practice as a practice of care for the work we do and setting conditions of distribution as well. So maybe that's for... Yeah, another conversation, but
it's amazing how much access also really spreads out onto so many other issues. Flavia earlier was talking about labor also as an access issue. It becomes quite expansive when it's taken seriously like that. I hope that other institutions would just like look at the document that I made and just do whatever it says in a way that like I don't know. Everything that I've learned about it has always been because of other people and all of their work. And it's really Black, Indigenous, people of color, mostly queer femmes that are disabled, that are like doing the work. And so I feel like, you know, everything that I shared earlier, it's like I've digested so much of what they said. I actually should be like a walking bibliography, actually. So in a way, like I hope that people would take the Common and Accessibility document and just go with it, also digest it. And also, it is so much of my work that like you don't even need me anymore for it. I put it all there, you know, because I'm still going to keep learning and going about the pace that I was able to do. There's so many things that I learned and so many things that I did wrong and failed at, let's say.
I'm just going to catch us up a bit with the chat because there's some really important things in there. I think the most, but a very significant thing that Jeanette's put there is that that it still happens that buildings are built without being accessible right now. New buildings are being built that are inaccessible, and I think that's really. Like, I think in a way that points to the idea of relying on a legal structure to protect people who have, it has been, you know, that it has historically been set up to exclude and oppress is a very risky one. And I also want to go to this other point that Jeanette made where she said that she saw a tweet today that was from a deaf person speaking about their joy at being in a deaf festival, in a deaf space, and that they were crying of having to go back to their own life. And I think that's something, Yeah, this question of like, how to say, like, spaces, like spaces where you don't have to explain, or spaces where like people get you, that like the necessity of that kind of space, whether it's in dealing with ableism or structural racism or other types of oppression, like the massive importance in a type of in terms of, yeah, just sustaining oneself in having the opportunity to be in spaces where people get you and you don't have to explain and you don't have to start from the point of of like what Jeanette said, of having to share her pain in order to be taken seriously. I think like that's so fundamental. And I wonder if anyone on the panel or in the audience would like to speak to any of that, or if you want to say anything, Jeanette. The spaces are very rare. Yeah. They are. And you're also intimacy. Speaking about access intimacy, or Nolly speaking about access intimacy.
I just want to say one thing about access intimacy. This text and concept by Mia Mingus is like a gateway into a really special place, I think. Access intimacy for me was like a tool that once I knew what that was, as Mia Mingus also describes too, like that access intimacy is just when somebody, you're with somebody and they just like get your access needs. They don't have it 100% perfect, but they just understand that they're there. It's like emotional intimacy, sexual intimacy, familial intimacy, and then access intimacy is another one that, like, once you're actually able to name it, you can cultivate it as a practice of care, that actually you can make access intimacy happen in spaces. Highly recommend to read it.
I'm also going to follow up Jeanette's point in the chat. Thank you, Stacey, for that intro, where she's saying one of the biggest misconceptions of the Netherlands is that it is a progressive country. And she says, I'm sorry, not sorry to say, but in the Netherlands, we don't give a fuck about disabled people. And I think that's something I kind of wanted to ask you, Jeanette, because you spoke about it in your talk. So precisely is also the way that different forms of exclusion and oppression layer over one another. And like you talked very precisely about the relationship, or like the intersection of ableism and racism. And I think in terms of access practices, I think that's something I think is very important to work through, that access will never be about like one specific area of oppression or one specific set of needs, because everyone is a very complex and plural person with many, many different aspects of identity and lived experience. And Jeanette's saying there's not a collective awareness or action on making room for disabled people. And I kind of wanted to ask, thinking in the Dutch context specifically, because obviously I'm not from here, but I have lived here for quite some time. And I wondered a bit about if anyone in the panel wanted to talk about the ways that the kind of like systematization of problems in the Netherlands, like how that impacts on different types of access, because I think it's something like the society, as that the way I experience Dutch society is it so much about kind of on the one hand universalizing an idea of progress, that like everyone is equal and everyone is patently not equal, but also a kind of separation of like solutions where it's like, okay, so you're homeless, we have a space for you to go, like you're disabled, we have a space for you to go. And it's this kind of separation of people into their identity needs and characteristics. And I wondered, yeah, if anyone wanted to speak anything about this, because I think it's something really important about how to address that in this this context specifically.
Am I the only disabled Dutch person here right now? Okay. I do recognize that it's always trying to symptomize, always try to find the problem and then try to solve it, where there should be another way of thinking. Just don't wait for the problem to appear. Try to think. Sorry, I wasn't prepared for this tonight, so I'm improvising a lot, and I know my head is a bit cloudy. But I do think the way of thinking in the Netherlands has always been that we try to find solutions, and we don't try to think ahead of the solutions, and just try to make the world as accessible as it could be. And we don't see that. I was sitting in a train last week, and I was helped into the train by a ramp, and I drove to my place, and an old couple were sitting across of me, and they say, "Wow, it's so good that you can actually get into this train and drive with it. Because they haven't seen anything like that before, and that says enough. It isn't visible. People are only confronted with it when they actually meet these people. They aren't on television. They aren't. We are always hidden, and I think that's why there isn't any why everything is going so slowly, because we have to every time point out there is a problem and then try to fix it instead of trying to find ways to not have these problems. That's very Dutch.
So more reactive care rather than preventative care.
Yeah. And then always wondering why there aren't any people around. So that's, you do get that question, why aren't you here? Well, because you didn't think about it.
I also had a funder actually ask me in person, so one of your targeted audiences, disability communities, are there any? You know, like, and I was like, what? And this is also something that Mia Mingus talks about too, the inaccessibility cycle. Of course there aren't any, there aren't accommodations, you know? So that was amazing to actually, and so this, as Flavia said, like this, this man in a position of power that's asking that question, you know? And it's just like, it's so hard to respond to such a thing too without wanting to just explode, you know, and then trying to keep it together to give some sort of answer. It's a challenge. Yeah. Is it worthwhile, you know? Yeah, maybe I didn't explain that exactly, but it was this question of like, well, where are they? Are there any, you know, and...
I don't know if it helps, but if you just plainly look at the numbers, 1 in 5 people has a disability. So if you look around and you don't see people with a disability, why aren't they there?
Yeah, it's a similar problem that we have at school, so I want to invite more disabled students, for instance, to our school. But if I look at how horrible it is to get into our university, of course they're not coming to our school. Of course they won't be. We cannot be more inclusive if the building is just a fence for many people. Definitely something.
We're just coming up to time, but I want to see, does anyone else in the audience want to, are there any other questions, comments? So we can take another 5 minutes just to take.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask how you would approach representation of disabilities without othering them or making their narrative separate from able-bodied ones, although they are. But I don't know, I wanted to ask about that because it's something which has concerned me. Because obviously people need to know about the experiences that disabled people have, but it has to be done so in a sensitive manner. And I wanted to know from some experts what your thoughts are.
When you call us experts, then we get quiet.
Sorry about that.
I mean, just on top of my head, I'm just thinking, like, it depends on, like, what your intentions are. Like, if your intention is to, like, level out the statistics, or if you're, like, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
It's okay if it's not coming naturally.
It's not a direct response exactly, and maybe I'm too focused on communication sometimes, but that's one of my love languages, and that's how I can also connect and go deeper, or how I try to. I mean, as I said with the access note, whether an institution makes one or an event organizer makes one for the event, like you saw with this event here, or like this amazing new kind of document, a tool of communication, the access doc or the care writer. Curators can ask artists, do you have an access doc? And you can also share the various links because there's a few different people developing this more deeply. And this can be really a direct way of actually engaging with someone's needs, without just obsessing over the disability part. It's actually, the more that we do that, we all realize more that we all have needs. And I think that maybe that can help without focusing so much on representation, but more about modes of accommodation, hospitality, being together.
There's one other tiny thing. People are afraid to acknowledge they don't know what to do. Maybe it's good to just acknowledge that you don't know and be able to ask to someone, what do you need? Somehow, I don't know if it's a Dutch thing, but we are too proud to acknowledge that, and that it's also part of the problem, I think.
Yeah, and I think I would just add around sort of questions of representation. I think there's also always like, on what subject matter do people have to speak about in order to be heard publicly? So, you know, so like what Jeanette said in her presentation that, I wrote it down, where she said, I feel the need to showcase my pain to be taken seriously, you know? And I think in a world in which, like, people want to talk to Jeanette or to anyone about, like, where people want to talk about stuff and not only about, like, what someone represents, then that's also a really important part of it. It's, like, to have the serious conversation, like, okay, I recognize that there's things that I don't understand and what can I do to change my practice, but also being like everyone is also more than the issues that they represent by their embodiment, because those are constructed socially and they can be changed through social practices. I'm just gonna, is there any like last points?
Uh, Pranila cited this in her talk, and it also is in the recent Johanna Hedva essay that they wrote now, I think, 10 years later after Sick Woman Theory. But it's you also said it, too, about this, like, being a caregiver and a caretaker. Hedva was saying how, like, that's the same thing. And I just, I think it's really important to stay with that kind of thing. Like, some of the people closest to me who are living with disability or illness, I mean, they provide the best care. And, you know, and it's just to kind of expand that out rather than this one-sided thing about, like, someone needing care or, like, needing a lot or this burden kind of talk. And, yeah, you said that too, so it's nice. Okay, I'm going to stop talking now.
Thank you. I do believe that hackers and designers have some thanks that they want to give. I can make that happen. I'll read them out for the people listening once the projector powers up, but just to say we'll be around, please feel very welcome to join in a slightly less formalized version of this conversation, because that'd be really, really nice. Thank you to all of the speakers.
Thank you for moderating.
Is it coming through? There's a few things. We consulted Mel, Lauren Wren Britton, and Isabel Parr on actually what things we could do to make this event more accessible. They're on vacation now, so they're not even watching the stream, but they're going to watch the recording, and I hope they get this message. The graphic design, this GIF animation, this transformative one that you've seen, was made by Menko Dijksterhuis, who I think will also watch the recording. And I'd like to thank Framer Framed for being such good hosts and on the conversation of care, taking so much attention and time to care. When it comes to accessibility of this event, they let us walk into their space and measure doors and toilets, and you know, there's this audio cable that has to go up on the pipe and then around on this bar and then all the way down back to where Jacopo is, just so that there's no cable on the way to the bathroom. There's all these steps that were taken. Thank you, Ebise and Jean, who has been sitting behind this computer, making sure it doesn't turn off. And then also Margarita, hi. But also Lillian and Marco from the HUM, who are hosting us on their online live stream, and showed us also a bit the ins and outs of being a hybrid and trying to be accessible and hybrid with our cultural events. And then there is Silvia Boschiero, I'm pronouncing it wrong. Thank you, Silvia, for taking photos. Jacopo Fresia, thank you for audio. Soner, thank you for streaming. And, now we can. Kanach, here's your pomegranate molasses straight from Afa, Lebanon. And Vasilis. And Pernilla. And yes, Stacy, and there's also one for Jeanette, which is just gonna hang out here and I can ship it to her. And then since Eric is sitting there and we had an extra one, you can have one too, Eric. Thank you for participating in the conversation. And of course, this is not free. This is paid for by taxes and the Stimularings Fund, Creative Industry NL. So thank you to our funders for making this event possible.